Those Who Love God, the first talk in a series entitled Those Who Belong to God, was presented by Ron Julian on August 4, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Things that I have been thinking about for a long time is the different ways that the people of God are described in the Bible. It is very common in the Christian world to kind of focus our attention on statements like the people of God are those who believe in Jesus. And in fact, there are theological traditions among us that so concentrate on that idea of believing in Jesus as the thing that characterizes the people of God that they want to argue that essentially that's all that characterizes the people of God, and to suggest that anything else need be true of us except that we believe that Jesus is the Messiah and that he rose from the dead would be to somehow be insisting that we're saved by works or something like that. But one of the things that has struck me is that as I look through the New Testament connects salvation with a whole array of things. It doesn't just describe the people of God as those who believe in Jesus. It describes them in a number of ways, and in ways that seem to suggest that it's not really an optional sort of thing, that that the people of God are X, Y, and Z as much as they are people who believe in Jesus. Both Jack and I sort of independently have done the exercise here in the last several years of going through the whole New Testament and basically looking for statements like that. Where are the places where the people of God are described, where you see a picture of what it is that differentiates those who belong to God and the people of this world? And what has been striking to me is the number of different descriptions that we find there. Well, that's the sort of thing that I have been thinking about and writing about in this theoretical book that I'm working on, which I have been getting some work done on this week, which is good. But I thought what I would do, since that's in fact what I'm thinking about and writing about, is that for several weeks here, I'd like to just sort of pick several of those qualities and talk about them a little bit, what I think the Bible is suggesting about them and what it means to us. And we want to really come to understand how faith in Jesus is related to these qualities that the Bible talks about. And I would say that the biblical picture is that to believe the story about Jesus without having it arise from the kinds of qualities that we're going to be talking about is really a meaningless thing. That we can see examples of people like the Judaizers in the Bible who were not unbelievers. They were Jewish Pharisees mostly who believed that Jesus was the Messiah. Nonetheless, Paul called down a curse on them in the book of Galatians because there was something missing. This belief in Jesus was motivated by something different than the kinds of qualities that really characterize the people of God. So, on the other hand, I want to emphasize, and it's very important to emphasize when we talk about things like this, that I don't think the biblical picture is, nor would the evidence of of experience, would that suggest that these qualities that I'm going to describe are something that come upon us all at once? You know, I go forward and all of a sudden there are these, you know, I don't know, Jack has a list of 22 or something, I think. I haven't counted yet for myself, but however we want to number these qualities that the Bible talks about, I don't think that in our experience they are something that come upon us all at once. In fact, I would argue that our life in this world is essentially a process of going through the trials of our faith in life such that we come to terms with these issues, so that we ultimately find ourselves agreeing and willing to acknowledge that certain things are important and true and valuable and so on. So if in the various things that we're going to talk about, you find yourself asking the question, is that true of me? I think that's a good question to ask, and an important question to ask, but I don't by any means want to terrify anybody and suggest, if I'm not absolutely confident that I can say this is true of me at this moment in my life, then I must not be a believer. That's not what I'm suggesting. But ultimately, these are the things, I think, that we have to come to terms with. I want to talk about one specific thing today. In general, I would say that there are a number of areas in life that we have to essentially, through the process of rebirth that God is bringing about in His people, that we come to a new evaluation and a new understanding of a variety of things. But one of the things that we have to come to a new understanding of, if I can call it a thing, is God Himself. That by nature we are reluctant to even believe that God is there. And if we do believe that God is there, we are very inclined to trivialize Him or mistrust Him or any number of things. What I want to focus on today is just one particular theme that you find in the Bible, and that is that the child of God, the chosen one, the saint, is the one who loves God. That's what I want to talk about this morning. Let me start with a passage that I think is very, very important, foundationally important in our understanding of God and what He's about, and has always been problematic to me. This passage talks about both loving God and loving our neighbor, but I want to concentrate just on the idea of loving God today. We'll come back to, somewhere along the line, we will probably come back to the issue of loving our neighbor. But I'm in Mark chapter 12, verse 28. And one of the scribes came and heard them arguing, and recognizing that he, Jesus, had answered them well, asked him, "What commandment is the foremost of all?" Jesus answered, "The foremost is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." And the scribe said to him, "Right, teacher, you have truly stated that he is one, and there is no one else besides him. And to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as himself, is much more than all burnt offerings and sacrifices." And when Jesus saw that he had answered intelligently, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." I have been thinking about this passage for a number of years. I'm basically a slow learner. I have been wrestling with two ideas as I look at this. I'm torn between two conceptions of what's happening here, and in fact, wondering whether, in fact, both of these conceptions are valid and appropriate, depending on how we think about it. First of all, if we think about what Jesus is saying here, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, pointing back to this commandment from the Old Testament. When I think about this commandment as the pinnacle of the expression of God's moral will for mankind, when I think about it in all its fullness and its highness, I realize that I have failed miserably at both of them, loving God and loving my neighbor. All my life, I have basically been inclined to be preoccupied with myself. And lest I make it sound like I have some unique problem, or I basically think that you're the same way. I've been watching you. I mean, I have to watch you because I do have to look out for myself, after all. So, when I think about this commandment, on the one hand, it's sort of terrifying. I mean, love God with all your heart and soul and strength. I mean, I just have not done that. I mean, that's just not true. So, in one sense, then, I find that commandment sort of on one side of this gulf, and I'm glad to go and read Paul talking about how we're justified by faith and we have been brought out from under the law, and that commandment represents kind of the pinnacle of the law that I have been brought out from under, that I have been forgiven and justified in spite of the fact that I am not like that description. These two great commandments have not characterized my life. And so, in that sense, I have been freed from them. When I think about it in those terms, the commandment to love God as myself, no, love my neighbor as myself, to love God with all my heart, soul, and strength, it seems like an impossible ideal. Like, you know, something that is out there that I could, in this life, I can hardly imagine that I could attain to. On the other hand, Jesus doesn't talk about it as if it were an impossible idea. The New Testament seems to speak of the love of God as a very necessary quality in the life of every believer. When Jesus teaches about this stuff, it's hard to really think that he's pointing to these commandments as some impossible ideal that we can't in any way accomplish. Because when we look at Jesus' interactions with the Pharisees, part of what he's doing when he interacts with them is basically charging them with having blown off these commandments and found a very clever way to justify themselves in doing it. I have come to think that, in a sense, both of these two things that are in tension are true. On the one hand, if we look at at what human life is supposed to look like, you and I ought to recognize that we have failed to love God and to love our neighbor the way we ought to. I mean, that's a fundamental description of what the problem is with us as sinners, is that we have not loved God the way we ought to, and we have not loved our neighbor the way we ought to. So, on the one hand, I think these commandments do represent something that ought to humble me and bring me to God looking for his mercy. And yet what is striking to me is that believers, those who are saved, those who come under the blessing of God in the New Testament, are sometimes described as those who love God. And the distinction is between those who love God and are going to enter into his favor and those who do not, and who are going to enter into judgment. And that's very striking to me. I think we have to take it seriously that in a very real sense, the commandment to love God is something that we are called on to do in this life. And that there is a very real sense in which the people of God do love him. Some of the passages that I'm thinking of are, for instance, in Romans 8:28, that great passage that provides a great deal of comfort to me in the midst of the chaos of my life sometimes, where Paul says, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who believe in Jesus, to those who are called according to his purpose." Well, I just slipped. He doesn't say all things to work together for good to those who believe in Jesus. He says all things to work together for good to those who love God. So, in Paul's thinking, I mean, I think he could have said those who believe in Jesus if he had wanted to, because he's clearly in Romans talking to his readers and giving them an explanation why the belief in Jesus is so central to the salvation that God has to provide. And yet here, it is those who love God, those who are called according to his purpose. Those who are called according to the purpose of God are those who love him. And I don't mean to suggest that we're called because we love him. I think rather it's the fact that we are called that makes us people who love God. Another statement is found in 1 Corinthians. It's a quote from the Old Testament. Paul says, "Things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him." And then in several places in the book of James, "Listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him?" So, I mean, you can see if we were to replace those who love God with those who believe in Jesus, we as part of the evangelical culture would find it very easy to understand what he's talking about there. But what's so striking to me is that that's not the language that was used. These people who are going to inherit the kingdom of God, who are going to enter into this blessing that no one has even seen or imagined, those for whom life is working towards an ultimate good, no matter what happens, the ones for whom all of this is true are those who love God. So, what does it mean to love God? And how would I know whether I am a person who loves God or not? Well, I don't know that I can speak exhaustively to this, but I can tell you a few things that I have thought of that make sense to me as I look at the Bible. I think it's important for us to be careful about the way we think about this word love. We are used to and have experienced those situations, perhaps in a worship service or in some deep emotional point in our life, where we may experience a very fervent emotional reaction to God, you know, akin to that fervent emotional reaction of being in love with someone that I might want to marry or something like that. That I feel this deep emotional reaction, such that I find myself, maybe I'm crying and maybe I'm calling out to God in praise or gratitude or something. The emotional side of our experience as Christians is not to be looked down on. I am not by any means suggesting that. And I think those who love God may very well come to places where they experience emotions like that, and I think that can be a very fine thing. But I think to assume that emotional state is to be equated with loving God would be the same kind of mistake as assuming that emotional state that we get into when we meet somebody and fall in love is what the experience of love in marriage over a lifetime is supposed to be about. Emotions play a part in marriage, and emotions play a part in loving God, I think. But I would say that in each case, the love that is required, the love that is being talked about, is talking more about a profound commitment of the heart than it is a particular emotional reaction. The main reason I say that is not to look down on the emotional reaction, and I really want to emphasize that. I would hate for somebody at a certain point in their life having a deep feeling in their relationship with God to have the thought go through their mind, boy, Ron would really think I'm being a jerk. That's not true. It's not true at all. And I mean, I have had those same emotional reactions myself. All I want to really emphasize, though, is that that emotional reaction, I think, is not to be equated with what it means to love God. And partly it's just from practical experience. I look back in my life and see any number of people who have had that wild emotional experience at a certain point in their relationship with God who eventually blew it off and wanted to have nothing to do with Him. Loving God is something more fundamental, I think, than that experience. So all I'm really trying to say is having that experience is not necessarily equated with loving God, and a person can love God and not be feeling that intense emotional reaction. That when the Bible talks about loving God, it's talking about something else. Let me see if I can fill in the picture a little bit here. There are different ways that you can come to get a feel for the way a word is used and what it might mean. Sometimes it can be helpful to see it in conjunction with what the author thinks about as being its opposite and see how they work together. And I see the Bible in various places, naturally enough, connecting what we translate in English as love with hate. That there are these two qualities, I love or I hate. And oftentimes, when the Bible talks about loving and hating, it really comes down to a choice. I have these two alternatives, and I love one and I hate the other. And various options. A good example of what I'm talking about is in John 12, where Jesus says, "He who loves his life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world shall keep it to life eternal." Now you see how we could mistakenly, I think, look at that and say, okay, love life and hate it, and you're supposed to be a person who hates your life. All right, so a person who loves his life then would be someone who's going along and he's doing something and he's feeling emotionally up. Hey, this is fun. I'm going to Camp Harlow. I'm going to have a barbecue. I'm going to go swimming. I mean, this is great. That person is obviously doomed to hell. And likewise, I'm miserable. I'm morose. I wish I were dead. I must be one of the chosen, right? I mean, is that what Jesus is saying? Is it, well, no, it's not. The idea of loving and hating your life in this situation has to do with it. I think about it in terms of what do I think of as my prize? What do I think of as the thing that I cling to and long for and want above everything else? The thing I love is the thing that I have given my allegiance to. So yes, I'm with you. Like, in a sense, like in a marriage, that commitment that I make to another person that says, we're together, I have chosen to be with you. And if someone else comes along, I'm not going with them because I'm committed to you. Well, there Jesus is talking about our life in this age, what we have in this world, that ultimately I can either be committed to it in the sense of this is my prize, this is what I'm looking for, this is where I expect to find the thing that is going to satisfy me, or else, no, I don't love my life in this world, I hate it. I love the inheritance that God has for me instead, the life that He has promised me. I hate this life and I love that life. Again, not hated in the sense of that I'm miserable in it, because I think I can hate my life and still be living in a way that's emotionally healthy. I mean, that I respond to things that are pleasurable with pleasure, and I appreciate things that are worthwhile, and so on. But when it comes down to where is my commitment? What have I committed myself to? Where is my heart? My heart is not in this life. If it has to go, I'll say goodbye, because my heart is not in it. My heart is in this other place. I think this gives actually, in fact, a pretty good picture of what the Bible is talking about when it uses the word love and when it's talking about loving God. Another good example is in Luke 16, where Jesus says, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." And there, it's just this fundamental choice. I can't have them both. And so the question is, which one do I love? Where is my commitment? Where is my heart? Which one do I look at and say, yeah, that's it. That's the guy I'm going to follow. That's the guy I want to be with. There's another, what I think of as enlightening use of the word love. In fact, several uses of it that I think are helpful. In 1 John, we see the language, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Again, we have to be careful in understanding what's involved here, because there's a sense in which loving the world is not a bad thing. I mean, we all know John 3:16, God so loved the world. What is God violating his own advice here in 1 John? No, it's a different sense. But what we're talking about here is, again, that commitment. Where is my heart? What am I about? When I look at it, do I see my delight, or ultimately is my delight to be found somewhere else? In 2 Timothy, Paul says, "In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing." There, his appearing, that's talking about the day when Jesus returns. And those who receive the crown of righteousness are, along with Paul, those who have loved his appearing. Now, you can see again, it's not like being in love, being in sort of a fluttery emotional state thinking about Jesus coming back, but it is that sense that my heart is there. When I think about what is it that I really want, what is it that's captured my heart, I think Paul is suggesting that the people of God are those ultimately who have seen that his appearing, his coming back, is that thing that is going to fulfill their lives and their hearts. That's why their hearts are there. That's why they love his appearing. Okay, so it seems to me then that these passages kind of help us get a feel for what we're talking about here. The person who loves God is the one who sees God, his character, his promises, as ultimately being their treasure, their prize in life. We have chosen him. We cling to him. We're longing for what he has to offer. We look at his values and we look at the values of the world and we say, the way he looks at things, that's the way I want to look at things. Because he's got it. The world around me, the people around me, they really haven't got it the way he does. And so, in my heart, as I confront the choices before me, all of the different things around me that I have to choose from, that there is this mostly invisible option out there, this mostly invisible object of my choice that is God, his kingdom, his promises, his character, that I see him in with the eyes of my heart and say, that's my treasure. That's who I want to be like. If there's anybody's favor that I want, I mean, you have to understand me. I am a person who, like many people, I think, but especially for me, I hate the displeasure of other human beings. I mean, if we talk about fearing men, I have a real tendency in myself to do that, I think. So I'm not speaking lightly here, but ultimately it comes down to when I ask myself, whose displeasure is it that I would least want to experience? The answer ought to be God's, because I love Him in a way that I don't love the world around me. I am not, my heart is not in this age, in this world, the way it is with Him. So then, if we talk about those who love God and the connection between believing in Jesus, the thing is that the gospel of Jesus Christ confronts us with various realities about life, about God, about ourselves, that are by nature, I think, by our nature, painful, unacceptable. We're not really interested. To embrace the gospel means to have a change of heart about what is the bottom line in life. What is it that I'm about? What is it that I think is really true and important? So, in the gospel, I see something of God. I see God saying, "You're a mess." He's talking to me, but some of it got on YouTube. You need help. First of all, you're an evil person. And that's a terrible thing. And so in the gospel, I see God doing this amazing thing of entering into His creation and dying in order to pay the penalty for my sins. God saying, forgiveness is a crucially important thing for you because you need it. And so for the gospel to really mean something to me, this thing about God, that He is good and that He is holy, and that I am not, and that He has reached out in mercy, that has to mean something to me. His merciful character, His offer of mercy to me, has to mean something to me, or the gospel is really not going to mean anything to me. And then likewise, in the gospel, I see a promise of deliverance from sin. And there's a whole package wrapped up in that. If I offered to deliver you from lasagna or something, I mean, you say, "Oh, gee, thanks, I guess," right? I mean, I don't actually particularly feel like I need to be delivered from lasagna. In fact, I sort of like it. You'd kind of think, well, maybe, you know, I appreciate the offer. It's kind of about the best you could do, right? Well, if somebody comes along and offers to deliver me, how significant that is depends on how much I think that the thing that I'm off, the salvation that I'm being offered is the right salvation. It's saving me from the thing that I really need to be saved from. And so, in the gospel, when we see the forgiveness in the gospel leads then to this place where we are under the grace of God so that His work can begin in our lives to ultimately bring us into a righteous kingdom where we are freed from our own sinfulness forever, that deliverance, that promise of salvation, in order for the gospel to mean something to us, that particular kind of deliverance needs to mean something to us. And ultimately, it comes back to the character of God. I see in God and His character something worthwhile. I'm sorry that I am not like Him, and I wish that I were like Him. And so, His character, His mercy, His promise of deliverance, all that is wrapped up in that, I look at Him and I say, I love that. I'm glad that He's being merciful. I'm glad that He's delivering me. I want to be like Him. I look at Him and I see, this is what I want my life to be about. So, there are a whole series of truths that are wrapped up in this. God is good. I am evil. God has forgiven me at great cost to Himself. God has promised to save me totally from this evil world. If His goodness, His mercy, His salvation are becoming my delight, if I'm glad that He is good, I'm glad that he's merciful. I want to be saved. I want to be like him. Then I think, I am a person who loves God. And I must love God in this way, ultimately, in order to truly be a person who believes the gospel in a significant sense. Now, there are two more things I want to say, and then we'll have a chance for comments or questions. They were... Oh, yeah, okay. Number one, I knew I should have written this down. I just get to the end here. I have two things I want to say. I want to reemphasize that coming to love God in this way, in one sense, we can say that it is something that happens to our heart from the very beginning, that it is implicit in regeneration, in this new birth that God brings about. That by nature, I am so suspicious of God that I don't really even want to admit that he's there. And so by coming to this place where I embrace and believe the gospel, there is a significant sense that I have become a person who can love God in a way that I was not before. And so in one sense, I think it happens right away, in that I'm a different kind of person than I was before. But the Bible and experience both suggest that, in fact, the working out of that attitude is something that is going to happen over time throughout our lives. That our own sinfulness, which is still a very real reality for us, it's a very real reality, none of that fake reality, that our sinfulness is it's a competitor. I mean, yes, we have hearts that are newly willing to love God, but we're also sinners who are still just as glad to keep things as simple and as focused on ourselves as we can. And so that's why it very often takes the difficulties and struggles of this life to kind of break through for us to get a hold of the idea that, yeah, God, what he represents, who he is, what he has promised, that's really where life is to be found. It is not immediately obvious to us, even as new believers or even as believers who have been believers for a while, because it is so easy to get distracted. Nonetheless, the person who ultimately refuses to love God, who in the midst of their life will not let go of whatever it is they've got their hands on and reach out to grab for him instead, that's not a child of God. I mean, ultimately, the person who belongs to God is the one who has seen him to be the desirable one, the one who is in his character everything that I am not and that I want to be. So, there's this tension, and I think it's the place we're meant to live, where ultimately God and reality are sifting us out. But if you were to ask me what I think our lives are about, my opinion is that if we were to focus on the issue of loving God, that in the midst of our troubles, as much as we think that our troubles are fundamentally about us, about our suffering, and about finding a way to alleviate our suffering, my opinion at this point is that fundamentally that's not true. That in the cosmic scheme of things, that our troubles are essentially about shaking us out of our complacency and teaching us, in particular what we're talking about here, to love God, to see him for who he is, and to have him become our treasure. The other thing, then, that I wanted to say is, going back to the very first issue, looking at the passage where Jesus points to the two great commandments and says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, I think there's a very real sense in which we can say that is our call in this life, not just an impossible ideal that we will one day fulfill in heaven, but that what we are called to do now is to love God with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind, or whatever it says, and that in a very real sense, what Jesus saw is the difference between It's interesting. There are two different occasions upon which Jesus talks to, at least two, where he talks to one of the Pharisees, one of the teachers of the time, about the great commandments. And in one case, the Pharisee involved tries to justify himself and ask the question, who is my neighbor, when he's talking about loving your neighbor as himself. And Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. And there it seems very clear that that particular Pharisee is sort of trying to evade the impact of these great commandments and somehow justify himself as being one who fulfills them, when in fact he is a partisan, mean-spirited, unloving at heart person, especially when it comes to people like the Samaritans and the Gentiles and so on. In the example that we looked at earlier, the Pharisee that Jesus is talking to seems to embrace them, seems to have understood. Yes, he says, these commandments are more than sacrifice and burnt offerings. I mean, this is what God was really about. This is what God wants of us. And there seems to be a sense in which this is a person who has embraced them and seen them as what he wants his life to be about. And so I think in that sense that it is true. As much as you and I fall short, because we do, and I know it's just incontrovertibly true that I do not love God with the depth of commitment, the stability, and my love of God is a weak thing, and I know it. But still, I think these commandments are ultimately to point the people of God in the direction that we are to be going, and that there is a very real sense in which the people of God can be characterized as those who keep that commandment, not in the sense that we perfectly fulfill it, but in the sense that we have embraced it. We see it as what our lives ought to be about, and in essence, our lives are about that. So, it's not being justified by the law by any means, because we have earned nothing but condemnation for the weakness of our love toward God. But the fact is that as weak as it is, it's a mark of God on our lives. That we actually have moved from being suspicious and suspicious of and hating God, that we come to the place that we would see Him as our treasure and our delight. That's a very real thing, and it marks us as being people that belong to Him ultimately. Okay, well, that's all I wanted to say. Let's have some comments and questions. That's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, at one time I would have answered that very easily. I would have said, well, he's not far from the kingdom of heaven because he has correctly understood what God has required, but the next step is for him to realize that he doesn't fulfill it and that he needs God's grace. And maybe that's true. I just find myself sort of rethinking that at this point. And I'm inclined to think that he may mean something more like the fact that you have seen where the heart of God is to be found in the commandments in a way that many of the Pharisees did not. I mean, they had grabbed a hold of the insignificant stuff and missed the heart of it, is what Jesus' complaint was against them. Here is a teacher who has not missed the heart of it. He has seen what it's about. I'm inclined to think that what he's saying would be something like, that looks very good. I look at the rest of the Pharisees and I see this and I say, that looks very good. Now, the question ultimately is going to be, though, what do you think of me? And what I have to say about all of this and the salvation that I've got to bring, that it would be possible to see what the heart of it was about, but not sort of personally to be committed to it, to see myself as invested in the truth of that. And so I'm inclined to think that what he's saying is what remains to be seen is, what does this mean to you? And we'll see that ultimately in how you react to me. Chris?
The way you've described loving God is that you have this attitude of really wanting and desiring things of God and the ways of God. And naturally, somebody who loved God that way would, it would be sort of a natural working out of that love to act in good ways to other people and do various good things. But I guess my question is one of emphasis in regard to that action. I've heard and I've thought in the past that, let me just say first that it makes sense that what you were saying, that loving God would look like that, okay, that would make sense with salvation and the other Bible teachings. But I'm wondering, I've heard teaching on this, that loving God in this case is more akin to acting in a way which is pleasing to God. So it's more, it's not negating what you were talking about, but its emphasis is slightly different in that that it's more of a commandment to action or something like that rather than a commandment to an attitude. You see the difference between those two? They're not mutually exclusive by any means, but they have different emphasis. Right. What's your feeling on that? Why would you go one way versus the other? Okay.
Well, there are good reasons that someone might say what you just said about love fundamentally being this action of obedience or something like that, because we have statements in John, in the upper room discourse, and in 1 John and places like that where love of Jesus, love of God, is connected with obedience. You know, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments, and that sort of thing. So I can see why, I mean, there is a connection, and I wouldn't deny that there's a connection between the choices we make and the love of God that we have. It just seems to make more sense to me, though, that as I see the way the word love is used, that the picture would be, it includes what you're talking about, but it starts with the commitments of my heart. What do I value? What am I about? Such that then, when I come to the place, when I look at the commandments of God, and in particular, I think the commandments that Jesus was focusing on there in John, when he says, "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments," fundamentally was the law of love, that you love one another. Okay. So I would argue that the picture is, if you have this sort of understanding of God, a desire to have what he is offering, a desire to be like him, and so on, then that's going to show itself in seeing those commandments as a desirable thing. And again, it's not that we're perfect in our love for each other, but that instead of seeing that as some sort of an irritation that I put aside, I recognize, in fact, no, that's what God is about. That's what he's like. And so if I want to be like him, then that's what I want to be about, ultimately. I mean, I can't love this abstraction of God without having it work itself out into my life, which is, in fact, exactly what John says in 1 John, where he says, how can you love God whom you haven't seen if you don't love your brother who you have seen? I mean, I think that's what he's saying, ultimately, is that there's this connection between how I think about the thing that would qualify as a love of God is a thing that hits my attitudes deep enough that it affects the way I look at the world that I'm living in. It's not just an over there experience, but it encompasses my life so that it affects the way I look at you. So, but still I would say that when I look at these examples of how the word love is used and the kinds of things I see the Bible talking about, that it would be a mistake to say loving God is keeping his commandments, I think, as much as it would be to say loving God is going through three boxes of Kleenex at a worship service. I mean, that both of those things may have a relationship between this to this attitude, but the place it starts, I think, is in that attitude. And that it's just as possible for someone to coldly keep the commandments of God out of a sense of some self-righteousness and duty as it would be to get worked up into an emotional state over God and still fundamentally not love him. The reality is that personal commitment that leads me then to act in various ways. That's how I would look at it. I don't know if that makes sense, but yes.
Could you define attitude and desire?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I can. What you're going to have to ask me. What are you thinking?
I don't know if I'm trying to split hairs, but it just sounds like on one side you're saying we need to not behaviors, just kind of looking out of obedience to his commandments, but it's more of an attitude from which the commandments, obedience to the commandments stem. And then desire is kind of thrown in there too as being almost equivalent to attitude. And I don't know if you're using them as the same, in the same sense, or if there's a, because initially you started off almost attacking, not attacking, but just saying we need to put emotion in its place when we're trying to define love.
Yes, well, and especially there by emotion, I was mostly talking about that if I'm in that place where I'm really feeling warm and loving towards God, which is a great thing. I'm not objecting to that at all. But when I'm talking about desire and attitude, I mean, I could take my attitude towards God would encompass things like, I know that he is. I see that he is good. I welcome the fact that he is good. I'm not trying to hide from the fact that I'm not good. I mean, there's a whole series of things that involve my disposition towards God. As a part of that, I'm including desire in the sense that I could see the goodness of God and the mercy of God as something that's true but irrelevant to me. But what I'm trying to get at is that a love, that component that the idea of love brings out is that it is not irrelevant to me. I want it. I desire it in the sense that I see God's goodness as something that means something to me personally. So I'm glad that he's that way and I want to be like him, and I'm glad that he has promised to forgive and I want to be forgiven, and I'm glad that he has promised to deliver from sin and that's what I want, and so on. So yeah, desire is a component of our attitude toward God, which includes maybe other things. But see, I guess I'm distinguishing a little bit. I mean, these terms are very difficult to use with precision, but I'm not sure that I would exactly call desire an emotion. I mean, it is, I guess, but I mean to distinguish, you know, my emotional state kind of goes up and down. You know, I feel enthusiastic, or I may feel flat, and you know, I mean, kind of can go all over the map. But in the midst of enthusiastic feelings and flat feelings, my desire continues to be the goal that I am moving toward. I mean, if you could picture, I'm marching through the desert towards the promised land, and some days I'm, you know, hey man, this is going to be great, and some days, oh man, okay, one more step, which is kind of the way it's been recently, but one more step. But the fact is, if somebody came along and said, why don't you turn around, the fact that I'm it doesn't change the fact that no, I'm going over there. There's no way I'm turning around. So That's the kind of distinction I'm making between desire and emotion. I may be feeling crummy, but my commitment, the thing that my life is about, it remains unchanged. I haven't changed my mind about what I'm going for. Jack?
Back to Chris's point, it seems to me that it's pretty important that we see that it is fundamentally an attitude rather than merely obedience on two counts. First of all, it's possible to go through the motions of the obedience without having that obedience arising from and rooted in that attitude. And it's to those kinds of people that Jesus is going to say, when we say at the judgment seat that I did this and this and this and this, that he's going to respond and say, but I never did. So that it's not enough to obey. It's an obedience out of a heart that ultimately desires to obey. That is the only difference. And the other thing that's important about that is that it's not uncommon for us as Christians to kind of get on one another's case, because there are needs out there that need to be met, and we are commanded to love our brother and to love our neighbor. And here's one way that you can love your brother and love your neighbor. If you don't respond to this, you don't love your brother and neighbor, therefore you don't love God. And it's that criticism makes sense out of the emphasis that to love God is to obey. But we could criticize Jesus on the same grounds then, because Jesus, in the midst of healing a bunch of people, turned and walked away from the rest of them. Why? Because he didn't love God? I don't think so. It's because there were other practical things that, like he was weary or wiped out or whatever, that for one reason or another he walked away and he didn't meet their needs. But he still, the constant was, he still had that attitude of being someone who wanted to be like God and would have delighted to meet their needs under normal circumstances. We, of course, can often use that as a rationalization as well. And we always need to be aware of that. But if we define loving God as doing works, then we concentrate on doing the works to our detriment in both ways.
I'm going to turn it over to Chris and say one thing. I agree. I think that the distinction is a crucial one. That, see, my fundamental attitude towards the commandments in the Bible is they're not commandments in the sense that do this and you'll be okay. That is, you know, here's this thing, love this way, tithe this way, do this thing, keep this Sabbath, whatever it is, you do this and you'll be okay. We are very inclined to want to turn the teaching in the Bible into that, because I want to be able to measure, you know, am I doing okay? Well, let me look at the list. Okay, I'm doing okay according to the list. But that's not, I think fundamentally that is not what the commandments in the Bible are about. The commandments in the Bible are like, they're the call of God. They're saying, this is what I'm about. What are you about? And as I look at those commandments, I either find myself drawn to the God of those commandments and thus then working out in various ways in my stumbling steps at obedience, in my repentance over the fact that I'm not like what is calling me to, and so on, that I'm my attitude towards God, my disposition towards God is working itself out in the midst of those commandments. But I think if we enter into those commandments with the sense that, oh, okay, I'm feeling a little unsure where I stand with God, but if I'll only go and do this, then I can feel more confident, that's not the way it works. Because the connection between attitude and disposition and what I do, I think, gets tested in the midst of trials, because a trial hits me hard enough that I can't fake it. A trial hits me hard enough that I can't say, well, I'll just keep this list of stuff because I'm hanging on for dear life. And what I'm really about emerges ultimately over this long period of time, because I'm really getting sorted down to the bottom. And that's a place where that distinction, I think, is important. Now. Yeah.